your host for today, Jeff Pickle.
The Jennifer Campbell Show, Jeff Pickle from the 570 Newsroom, coming down the hallway, filling in here for Jennifer Campbell, who is in Nashville, Tennessee for the rest of the week, but she'll be back at the host chair come Monday of next week, filling in for Jennifer today, tomorrow, and Friday. We've got a great show lined up for you today. A little bit later on, around 9:30, we're going to chat with a couple students who are caught up in the ongoing Ontario Colleges faculty strike. We've heard a lot from the union. We've heard a lot from the teachers. We've heard a lot from the colleges themselves. We've heard that back and forth. We have not heard a lot from the students themselves. What are they going through? Where's their mindset at? How deep is the concern that they might actually lose the semester here as we're into the fourth week of that strike? Has to be very concerning. So we're going to talk to a couple students there at 9:30 about what's going on with the students on their end. But just off the top, starting the show on more of a somber note, of course, most of us have heard the news that broke yesterday about former Toronto Blue Jay ace pitcher Roy Halladay passing away at the age of 40. He was involved in a plane crash in the Gulf of Mexico. We heard kind of earlier in the day that there was a plane crash, and that plane was owned by Roy Halladay, but it wasn't confirmed for a little while if he was actually in the plane. And then later on in the afternoon, yes, making that confirmation that it was, in fact, Roy Doc Halladay in that plane. And I know during that period when people were wondering, you know, if that was Roy himself, and then you look over to his Twitter account and you see the last, you know, so many of his last tweets are about his you know, new passion for flying. Clearly is something he'd picked up in retirement and was passionate about flying, and there was videos and pictures of him around planes, so it certainly became, you know, far more conceivable that yes, that indeed was his plane. And as we said, confirmed that it was Roy Halladay passing away at the age of 40. In with me this morning is none other than the Blue Jay Hunter, Ian Hunter, 570's very own, runs the one of the best Blue Jays blogs around, and is the biggest fan of the Blue Jays I know. Ian, thanks for joining me, and clearly this has to be, you know, upsetting news that you came across yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, it's, we lost a legend yesterday. One of the best Blue Jays to ever play the game, probably one of the best pitchers of the last 20 years. It's sad, and it's when someone is taken like this soon, it's just, it's so unfortunate, because like all I can think about is how, you know, he has two sons. He was, you mentioned his Twitter feed, he was coaching his son's baseball game. He's a husband. Like, it's just, it's gutting. An entire Blue Jays fan base looked up to him. I mean, for a good portion of a decade, he was like the only thing, one of the only things to really cheer about for the Blue Jays. Because let's be honest, they weren't that watchable in the mid 2000s there. But he was, every 5 days, every start that he made, it was must watch television. And then he went over to Philadelphia, and it was almost like he was validated when he went to Philly. It was the whole United States opened up their eyes and said, wow, this really is the best pitcher in baseball right now. And everybody in Toronto knew it for many years, but because he played for the Blue Jays, he was just kind of under that shadow. But it's, yeah, I really don't know how else to describe it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And from what you know, you hear from you, and what you hear from, you know, other people who really follow the game and know the game, is, you know, we can talk about the baseball statistics and the baseball side of things, certainly, but the one thing that is pouring through, which was clear when he was a player, but to hear from the people who really knew him, they said, you know, as good as he was a player, this is truly one of those cases where, you know, his ability as a player was surpassed by, you know, who he was as an individual. And it's so amazing to hear these stories about, you know, it fills you with, you know, this sense that he was truly, every single person said, such an amazing, committed individual, such amazingly generous individual, and truly his, you know, the guy he was surpasses who he was on the field.
Yeah, because what we saw on television, what we heard from his time in Toronto was that he was, you know, very robotic. He was all business. He wasn't a big showboating guy on the field. I don't know if I ever saw a Roy Halladay fist pump in my entire life. He was just, he went about as, he was the consummate competitor. And then, but when he retired and he came back, he actually signed a one-day contract to retire as a Blue Jay in 2013, which I was always, that shocked me because I always thought he went out to greener pastures. He didn't have to come back and do that. But yeah, after that, he kind of turned into this wonderful human that he was all along. And we never really got to see that on television. And he's this, you know, fun-loving guy who likes to, you know, fly and coach his kids' game and just be, you know, a dad, which you didn't get to see on the field. You got to see that, live that through his Twitter feed and these anecdotes from his former teammates and coaches and things like that. And that's, I don't know, to me, that's kind of the more upsetting part about it because, I mean, he's a baseball player, but he's also a human. He's a father, you know, he's a husband. That's where it's really devastating.
And baseball is a sport where a lot of times you do, you know, the money they're making and the egos in that sport can, you know, potentially run wild. We see that with, you know, certainly a lot of stars, but he was certainly a guy you didn't see that with. And we, you know, I was just having different conversations around the newsroom with you. Like you said, he was fairly, you know, he was all business. He was down to business, but you never saw him complain. There was never an image of him getting into it with another guy on his team. There was never giving coaches problems. It was just, he was on the mound, he was pitching, he was off the mound. He gave this image, and you hear teammates say it was like, you know, there wasn't, you know, this ego that surrounded it. There wasn't problems. He wasn't, you know, just because he was a star, he wasn't, you know, causing issues in the locker room like you hear a lot of, which again, you know, is more just to this point that, you know, if being a true professional kind of, it comes at your, you know, comes as a negative thing as far as your star power, I guess that was something that Roy Halladay was willing to endure.
Yeah. I don't think I ever heard a bad thing about him during his entire playing career. Like nobody said one bad thing. The intriguing thing to me was that not a lot of people know that he had a lot of ebbs and flows in his career. He came up with the Blue Jays, his second career start, he almost threw a no-hitter. He was one out away. And then the following year, he had the worst year of his career. He was sent all the way down to single-A baseball. The Blue Jays had basically had to rebuild him. Pitching coach Mel Queen was a large part of rebuilding him. And then 2 years, he came back and won a Cy Young Award. And he was tremendous in Toronto, and then he went and continued and did it in Philly, threw a no-hitter in the playoffs, threw a perfect game, won a Cy Young all in the same year. I mean, save for a World Series ring, Roy Halladay did it all. Like, he was, I mean, I feel like he should be in the Hall of Fame just because he's, like, his career, if you go back and just look at his baseball reference page, it's ungodly.
It's nuts. When I was looking at his, you know, his awards and his numbers and all that stuff, if you have a few moments, look at it, because it's amazing. It is, you look at it like for a solid decade, his, you know, his pitching stats across the board, the number of complete games, the number of complete game shutouts, the number of his hitting, his average with his whip is, you know, always near the top. It's actually his, you know, almost, you know, you know how good of a pitcher was, but then you look at these numbers and it is incredible. And I want to ask you, that's the one thing, you know, that I recall hearing about Roy Halladay, which is something special, that he retooled his pitch. He totally changed what he was doing because it stopped working for him. In baseball terms, I mean, how difficult is that for a pitcher, such a, you know, finite skill, to throw that ball so fast and to put it in such a location? How difficult is that for a pitcher to change his pitch essentially to something brand new and then have success with it?
Oh, yeah, it's tremendously difficult. I mean, you hear of so many pitchers who fizzle out so incredibly quickly. They would, you know, guys like Roy Halladay would go down to the minors and you would never hear or see from them again. I mean, you just, you know, go back through the past 5-10 years in Blue Jays history. There's so many Blue Jays pitchers that fizzled out, but not only did Roy Halladay rebuild himself, he actually became better and he was dominant. And for a good 5-7 period stretch, I would say he was probably one of the best in baseball, if not the best.
No, absolutely. Now, one of the great stories that I read this morning or last night about Roy was when he had his first no-hitter, actually. Yep. And he you might know this story as well, where the day after, a few days after, every single member of the clubhouse received a commemorative watch that said, you know, it had engraved, and maybe you know the quote better, but it essentially said, "We did this together." You know, this was his no-hitter, but, you know, he bought a rather pricey watch for 60 guys in that clubhouse who said, you know, this wasn't my, you know, thing. This was a team accomplishment.
Yeah, that's probably a true token of the person he was. And I mean, let's be honest, baseball is a pretty individual sport, right? There's a lot, everyone has their own, it's a one-on-one battle. So for the most part, when you throw a no-hitter, I mean, that is driven by the pitcher, but he went out and got to watch for everybody involved. I mean, I can't ever think of that. Like, maybe if you win a World Series or you win a National League championship, but not if, I mean, that was his mantle and he shared it with all his teammates. You never hear of that ever. And that's what made him so special. That's the kind of person he was.
Yeah, truly a tragedy. Now, you mentioned before, you talked about Hall of Fame, and I know the Baseball Hall of Fame is, you know, traditionally the most difficult to get into. It's, you know, it's the one where notable big names are left off, mm-hmm. and tough to get into. I mean, I, you know, certainly not as engaged and involved with the sport as you are, but I certainly would have just assumed he would have been, you know, a clear Hall of Fame contender. Where do you think the baseball universe lies on that idea?
Right. Well, he was just inducted into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame this past year in St. Mary's. I believe he's not eligible for Hall of Fame induction until 2019, so not next year, but the following. But I mean, just looking at, he didn't have the length of career as you would typically see from a normal Hall of Famer. I mean, it was injury shortened, unfortunately, but during his peak, that 7 to 8 year stretch, he had the most ungodly numbers for a pitcher of the last two decades. So I would, you know, I'm thinking emotional right now, but I feel like he should be there. And the neat thing was that when he came back and he signed that one day contract with the Blue Jays a few years ago, there were some people who asked him, they said, well, if you go into the Hall of Fame, you know, just a hypothetical conversation, which cap would you wear? And he said the Blue Jays.
Yeah. Right?
And again, I think back to how much of an honor that is, because it's not often that you see a player come up with in Toronto, in Canada, and go to greener pastures to another team and then come back and re-sign. Like, you see what happened with Vince Carter and other guys that come up through Toronto and then just never want to come back. But Roy Halladay felt like he owed it to the Blue Jays to sign a one-day contract, and if he went into the Hall of Fame, it would be a Blue Jays cap, and that to me is, I can speak on behalf of a Blue Jays fan base, but I would say we'd be grateful for that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think he, you know, certainly in our generation, the generation that either could barely remember or not remember at all the World Series victories, you know, Roy Halladay was everything else for that team. You know, there was obviously Delgado and some great players, and Vernon Wells, some people fans of. There were some good players coming through, but no one really captured the spirit and the heart of fans, you know, in that later, you know, decade after the successful years like Roy Halladay did. So truly, you know, it is it hits a lot of fans, and, you know, the age and the way it happened makes it all the worse.
Yeah, but you make a really good point. I mean, I can vaguely remember 92-93, I was, you know, like 8-9 years old, but the Roy Halladay starts and games I vividly remember, because, as I mentioned, he was one of the only things to watch or surrounding the Blue Jays for a good 5 to 7 year period. And the way that he worked a game, it was, you know, surgical like precision. He wasn't a big strikeout guy, but he pitched to contact, and he would, most Roy Halladay games were like 2 hours or less, and complete games, mind you, and you never see that. And I think that's why, you know, there's never going to be another guy like Roy Halladay. The way the baseball is trending right now, it's going to more relievers, and starters are throwing even less, and they're not pitching to contact. They're trying to strike out guys, and Roy Halladay was the antithesis to that. He wanted to pitch a complete game every single start, and most times he did, and most times he just completely shut down the opposing team. And it was something incredible to watch. And looking back, I think we kind of maybe took it for granted, but now in his passing, I feel like his legacy is even more important than it was prior to his passing.
No, absolutely. Very well put, Ian. Thanks for coming in. Ian Hunter, the Blue Jay Hunter, joined me in studio. Talk about the very unfortunate news, the passing of Roy Halladay, Blue Jays ace, pitcher, hopefully Hall of Fame member. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back right after this.
Put the smart in your smartphone. Download the 570 News app and stay informed. 570 News.
All right, we're back with the Jennifer Campbell Show. Jeff Picklin filling in for Jennifer Campbell, joined in studio by none other than producer James Sebastian Scott. Now, James, we want to switch gears a little bit. We're going to open up the phone lines here, 519-570-2545. What we're going to be chatting about now is another one of my, you know, am I a grumpy man, old man issue of the appropriate time to unleash your holiday cheer onto the world. When is it? You know, this is something we see more often earlier and often. I don't know what I'm trying to say. We see it way too early. We see people jumping into the holiday spirit the moment Halloween's over. I'm not standing for it, but I know other people have very different opinions on the take. They say, hey, the earlier the better. When do you get in the holiday spirit? I want to get your take on it, James. And I do want to hear some callers on this. 519-570-2545. James, what's your take?
Usually, I'm a grumpy person like you when it comes to Christmas.
That's what I'm talking about.
I don't know why. I've always been that way. Maybe because it's so commercialized. But typically when I get into the mood, it's usually the start of December. But we don't usually put our tree up at my place because my wife loves Christmas stuff. So we don't usually put that up until after Remembrance Day. So
after Remembrance Day, I think that's not a bad one. Yeah. That's kind of curting both. And I have heard you are sparking a memory now. I heard that before, that, you know, that is a one of the I want to say not polite, but one of the respectful things to do is wait for certainly Remembrance Day to finish, to not, you know, overshadow the importance of that day, and then, you know, get into the holiday spirit. If you like, that's at least delaying it another 2 weeks if you're a person. Yeah, the thing for me is that other than just not liking to see other people, you know, celebrate joy and having, you know, being happy, I find that if you get too much, it's too much of a good thing. You know what I mean? If you spread out, if it's too much of a good thing, if you start getting in the spirit in November, early November, that's, you know, 2 months, that's 1/6 of the year you're in the holiday spirit. It's not like the shorter amount of time you're kind of fully in the holiday mode is it's a more intense, shorter period of cheer and of happiness and all those warm feelings that people get through Christmas. If you spread it out, it's kind of lukewarm, right?
Yeah. I have a hard time getting into Christmas spirit if there's no snow on the ground.
That's true too.
I come, everyone knows this. I come from a cold climate in Winnipeg that snow is not a problem for them out there in Manitoba. That's for sure. So every Christmas we would have like 40 centimeters of snow basically for Christmas. So it's hard for me to live here and get into that spirit if there's no snow on the ground.
Yeah, I get 100% what you mean. I typically, I'm fortunate enough to be able to utilize some family members and go down to Florida around the time of the holiday stretch there, and it always shocks me so much to see decorations and that sort of stuff out with like palm trees and just like 25 degree weather. I'm like, but I mean, clearly, I mean, people in southern climates, you know, celebrate Christmas and whatever holiday there is being celebrated. But like, it just always shocks me, it's so weird that the scene is so much different that, you know, I'm thinking like of all the, of what I'm used to and seeing, you know, the white day on Christmas and the snow coming down and then like being there and seeing the palm trees. And like, this is just so weird. Like, how do people get in the Christmas spirit in Tampa, Florida? Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
I think Florida needs to do some ice machine snowmaking stuff, you know what I mean?
It's weird because also a huge thing down there is the like inflatable decorations. We'll have the inflatable snowman, the inflatable Santa. It's all like inflatable, really kind of like cheesy looking stuff, and like lights, like the lights go intense with the lights, and it's like a bizarre thing. But then, you know, they turn off those inflatable things at night. So in the morning, you just see these like deflated like rugs that look like, you know, it was, you know, Santa or a sleigh or whatever. It's just a bizarre like feeling to be around there. But it certainly doesn't damper their attitude towards the decorations and that aspect of things. But I don't know. I just always found it different. But now are you also in another stage of your life now where are you decorating? Like, are you living with your wife? You guys, are you decorating the house? Are you, your situation, are you decorating the front at all? What's going on?
Yeah, so usually we decorate the tree, and then we have some other stuff that that my wife likes to put up in the house and stuff like that. But we don't go too crazy. We did put up some Christmas cards that we got from a lot of people last year up in the living room and stuff like that. We don't usually put anything on our door because we live in an apartment, so we just don't bother with that.
It's also true. When you live in an apartment, I mean, it's like, what's the point, right? It's like those other eight people are going to see it. thanks to Joe Martz for weighing on Twitter. I unabashedly love Christmas, but it should wait until after Remembrance Day at the earliest. Once December hits, bring it on. Okay, Joe, thanks for chiming in. I think James and I tend to agree with you.
Yeah.
All right. I think we solved it. I think you and I, James, sat down here with Joe on Twitter, and we just came to a conclusion.
We talked it out.
Perfect. We got to go to a quick break, little news, and then we'll be back with the Conestoga College, while the Ontario College teacher strike. We're going to hear from a couple students coming up after this.
570 News brings you airborne traffic reports for your morning and afternoon commute with Daryl Dahmer on 570 News.
Okay, we're back. It's the Jennifer Campbell Show, Wednesday morning. Thanks for tuning in on 570 News. And if you're watching on Rogers TV, Jeff Pickle today filling in for Jennifer Campbell. She'll be back right here in the host chair come Monday morning. And unfortunately, you're stuck with me for another 2 days, but don't complain too loudly. Thanks so much for Ian Hunter coming in early this morning, chatting with us about the unfortunate news, the passing of Roy Halladay, and then James Sebastian Scott just in the studio. And we just ourselves, the two of us, along with some help on Twitter, solved the issue of when it's appropriate to start getting ready for the holiday season. So thanks for James for solving that issue with me. What we're going to chat about now is the ongoing Ontario College's faculty strike now, believe it or not, in its fourth week, four long weeks that the teachers have been on the picket lines, and there has been no class in session, giving some very real concerns to students that they may lose the semester, something that's never happened in Ontario College's history. We've heard a lot about this from the faculty themselves, from the union side. We've heard a lot from the colleges. We've heard from those teachers, the ones who are on contract staff, who a lot of this turmoil is kind of based around trying to get more contract part-time workers into full-time teaching capacity. We've heard from those sides. We've heard some from students, but likely not enough what they're going through. I'm now in studio, happy to be joined by two first-year Conestoga College journalism students, Caitlin Mullen and Jessica Towers. Caitlin, Jessica, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
So the reason I have you two in is because in this time that, you know, you haven't been in class and not being able to, you know, pursue your hopeful career in journalism in the classroom, you've been blogging and trying to do some work that way, which is commendable. I know some people probably are just taking this as a long 3.5-4 week vacation, but you guys hard at work trying to do some journalism in your time off. And what no better really topic for you guys than to talk about what you're currently going through as students, not being able to be in class. So tell me a little bit about the piece you put together and the questions you were asking and who you heard from.
So Jessica and I took to Facebook on the Conestoga different group chats that they have posted. We mentioned that we were writing a piece, an opinion piece on the strike, and we asked students if they had any burning comments or opinions. and if they wanted their voices heard. We got a surprising number of messages. We spent the whole afternoon reading them. There was more than 200 people who got in touch with us, and then we sort of sorted through them and wrote a piece about it, because I think we all kind of share the same opinion on what's going on right now.
And what, you know, if you can, you know, 200, obviously a lot, first of all, a lot of people, maybe you touch on that in a second, but what you said, you know, generally speaking, you heard a lot of the same things. You know, Jessica, what, if you were to kind of put together the thoughts of most students, what are they saying? What are they thinking?
Most of them were really angry about the whole situation. The fact that they paid to go to school and they're not receiving the education that they want. And even if we do go back to school after this strike, like, it's all going to be crammed in and we're not going to get the hands-on learning or like the appropriate learning that we want. So that's what most students are kind of complaining about and like expressing their concerns about, is their education that they paid for.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the idea of, you know, even if, you know, they think they're saying we still can finish the semester, finishing a semester is one thing, getting that mark on a paper, but the idea that a lot of time for some, you know, very real and very necessary learning has been missed.
Yeah, definitely. College is pretty fast paced to begin with. So if we're going to be cramming these 4 weeks that we missed into the last little bit that we have, it's going to be really, really, really hard for us to get the learning that we paid for. Not to mention, when you go to apply for jobs after you graduate, they're going to be like 2017, 2018. Hey, wasn't that the year that they crammed everything into 2 weeks of classes? Like, we're not really getting the, like, the appropriate amount of education.
So kind of almost like the anyone graduating or in college in these years, there, it could be kind of stigmatized that this is the group, this is the cohort that maybe isn't as well, you know, rehearsed, isn't as well, you know, educated, I guess, or trained that, you know, other groups maybe.
Yeah.
Interesting. No, that is cool. I never really actually thought of that. Now, you said you had 200 or so responses. Did that number surprise you? Were you shocked that that many people were weighing in?
I know that many people were concerned about what was happening, but I was very shocked that the number of people messaging me, it was crazy. And we didn't have one single person who was on the for the strike side. Everyone was, they wanted it to end. They wanted to get back into classes. And I think that it was really shocking to see the number of people who were as angry as Jessica and I are in this situation right now.
Well, and you guys brought up a good point in talking about, you know, the fact that college particularly, I think it'd be quite a bit different than potentially a university strike, because, well, college is a more condensed schedule. Most, you know, most students are there for 2 or 3 years, not a 4 year or more. And it's such a hands-on aspect. You think about, well, certainly there's hands-on aspects to the journalism program, but you think about the nursing programs and the paramedic services and some of those other programs where, you know, you need those tools. Certainly a lot of the trade programs, you need those tools to physically do anything, where, you know, potentially in universities and in other programs, you can do more learning without those physical tools being there.
We actually had a nursing student, she's in her second year, she messaged us saying that she's missed 3 labs so far since the strike has began. And when she graduates, if she doesn't get the proper education that she needed, people's lives are on the line, because she's going to be dealing directly with public health and like with people. And if she doesn't know what she's doing, that's a big concern for not just herself, but the people that she has as patients.
Yeah. What about refunds? Has that been I know that was comments earlier I've heard. I've kind of haven't been following as closely as I was early in the strike, but are people wanting the, you know, the bottom line as well? Not just I'm getting robbed of my education, but hey, I'm getting robbed of some money here that I've paid.
Yeah, a lot of students have like expressed their concerns about the money that they paid, because college isn't cheap. Like, it's expensive. And most students like work after high school, like I did. I took a year off and worked and saved up my money. My parents did too, to help me pay for my education. And I feel like that it's just gone. Like, I wasted my money and we're probably not going to see any money back. Like,
yeah, there's a bunch of petitions going around. There's the first one was on change.org. Someone started a petition for every single day that the strike continues. They want money returned to them. Since the strike has gone on for so long, one of our classmates, Terry Foster, has actually started a second petition where students are looking to get their second semester for free, based on the fact that we've lost a big chunk of our first semester. And it's not fair for us to be paying thousands of dollars to get classes that we're not even in right now. Not only that, but there's international students who are paying double, triple the amount that local students are paying just to be here.
Yeah, I noticed that in the article, one of the students you talked to, a student from India, was part of your thing. You know, how many international students have you heard for? And, you know, you talked a little bit about, you know, as serious it is for all students, certainly, you know, for international students, this is a bigger deal.
Well, there's also the concern that if they push the semester and they extend it, which means they would have to extend second semester too, there's students who are living on visas right now from overseas, and what happens when their visas expire? Do they get to finish their classes, or?
And a lot of, I guess, just uncertainty for students. I know the province has said a couple, you know, things along those lines, saying that that won't be an issue for those students. But it sounds like at least maybe the messaging isn't reaching a lot of students as well. How do you let them know that about what some of the things that are happening and how it might change? Just curious, your thoughts now that we're in the 4 weeks, do you think, how long do you think it can go before they say the semester's lost? And do you think that, you know, we'll get to that point?
I think a lot of students think it's lost already. Right. There's a bunch of Facebook groups, and I'm going to say like twice a day there's people posting, you know what, at this point I just want to drop out and start over. At this point I just want to transfer to university. At this point I don't see a point in us returning, I just want to start over. So I don't really think it's fair. We're kind of all left in the dark, and we don't really know what's going on, when we're going to go back, how this is even going to work when we return.
Yeah, I think like the schools haven't really been informative either. Like, I know that they're not really getting the message across, or like trying to like convey anything to students. Like, they just haven't really been that informative on letting us know what is happening.
And how stressful is it? I mean, on a personal level, I mean, not knowing and going through this, you're doing your best to, you know, stay busy, but how stressful is it on you, just that not knowing and being in limbo?
I think it's really stressful, and I think it's more frustrating than it is stressful, because school is an investment, which means we're the largest shareholders in the institution. So without us, there is no classes. So for us to invest our money and them to kind of use us as playing pieces in the battle of education is sort of unfair. And I think a lot of students are way past the stressed out about their classes part and more frustrated that, like, this is our time, this is our investment, and, like, we're just getting left in the dark.
Yeah. Certainly not an enviable position to be in. Another thing, you know, because again, I was there on the picket lines the first day the strike was declared, and you know, the lead up to it, the talk was from both sides, from OPSU and from the colleges, was saying that, you know, we've never, or it's been at least a long time before we've lost any time to a strike. They've always been diverted, and classes have been running as scheduled. The strike happened, thought, okay, this will be a quick strike. It then took, you know, nearly 2 weeks for them to even begin negotiations, which was, you know, mind-boggling to a lot of people, how they weren't even apparently attempting to solve a situation. How, you know, speaking for yourself and the people you talk to, how has your, you know, kind of thought process changed when this strike started? I know, you know, people were kind of thinking maybe, hey, I had an exam that Monday, I could use that Monday off, nice. And then how those thoughts have changed, or how you've seen them change?
Like, at the beginning of the strike, like, I know, like, me and Kate were like, oh, like, maybe, like, 1 week off won't be so bad. Like, we can catch up on a lot of stuff that we've gotten behind in, or just kind of relax and chill. And after the second, third week, I started to panic. I'm going to say I panicked because I didn't know what was going on. And, yeah, it's really stressful for a lot of students. And, yeah, I think a lot of students were excited at the beginning, to be honest, because, oh, yeah, like, a week vacation, cool. But now we're all like, okay, this is not fair, like.
Yeah, at the beginning it was like, yay, an extended reading week, and now we're like, oh no, oh no.
Yeah, no, exactly. I know, like I said, I mean, I was down there and I talked to people, and a few people straight up said to me, no, this is actually perfect because I had an assignment due that wasn't done or whatever it may be, and now I'm, you know, got the day to do it. And I just imagine, you know, if I had the ability to chat with those people again, that those opinions may change. Well, you know, obviously not a... not a situation anyone likes and anyone wants to see. And again, congratulations, or applauding you two on, you know, doing your best to stay busy. I know, first of all, your teachers will recognize that, they'll know if you were busy and doing something, and you guys will obviously, you know it as well. You'll feel a step ahead of everyone else, because I'm sure there's a number of your classmates who aren't doing too much. But you guys, again, congratulations on staying busy and being productive individuals on your time off. Caitlin Mullins and and Jessica Tauris, thanks guys so much, and well, hopefully this thing will wrap up soon and you guys get back to the classroom.
Thanks for having us.
Not a problem. Okay, great. We got to take a quick break, and there'll be more of the Jennifer Campbell Show right after this.
John Wilson's Weather Guarantee. Weekdays at 7-11, only on 570 News.
And we're back with the Jennifer Campbell Show on Rogers TV, and of course right here on 570 News. Glad to be here at the host desk with you, traveling through this 9 o'clock hour, the little buffer period before Mr. Farwell comes in. keep the chair warm for Jennifer, and keep the chair warm for Mike, and keeping the chair warm for me right across from me, back in studio, the one and only James Sebastian Scott.
I feel like I'm your Swiss Army knife today.
You are. James, yeah. I just don't want to be here in here alone.
That's fine.
That's my number one thing when I come in, is like, I'll be fine. I just need someone either in one of those chairs, both those chairs, or on the phone. And because it's a scary, dark place when you're in here alone. I'm looking at yourself and technical producer Deanna in there, and I'm wondering, like, you guys are looking back at me, and I'm looking back at you, and I'm like, I don't know.
Well, you know, that's so what I'm here for.
If you were a student, or when you were a student, and you were 4 weeks into a strike, and it took them 2 weeks to get back to the table, and it seems like no one's that interested in finding a deal, where would your mindset be at?
Frustrated.
Frustrated.
Absolutely frustrated, because... like those students said that we had in today, you're paying for an education and you're expecting to get that education in return. And failure to do so is a failure on the part of college faculty, Ontario colleges as a whole. So I would be just as frustrated as every student might be at this point in time, 4 weeks into a strike. I think they just need to end it. They need to get over what it is that they're trying to get from the union and the province, and you know, just bear with it and give these kids the education they need.
No, I know. Yeah, I mean, I think that sentiment is certainly, you know, reflected in a lot of people. There's a lot of people feeling that exact way, that they, you know, it's hard to understand why this thing could keep going as long as it has.
Well, especially the amount of money that colleges bring in on tuition fees. I mean, that alone should be enough to make sure that these teachers have what they need, and apparently it's not. So where that disconnect is between the province and the colleges is something that they have to figure out, but it's taking way too long, and they just need to get a deal done and get these students back in the classroom.
Get him back in the classroom. No kidding. From the one and only James Sebastian Scott, laying the hammer down. Colleges, union, James is on your case. You better start running for the hills. James, I want to shift gears because I like to, like, you know, this is a bit of getting a chance to come in here and do this is a bit of a therapy session for me. So I'd like to find the thing that kind of enrages me a little bit. The one thing that enrages me today, I'd like to see it. I see it usually on a little website known as Twitter. And I like to then bring it up, and I don't have much else to say about it other than it bothers me. But this one, I think, was going to bother a lot of people. And, you know, the little description here is pretty fair. It's unclear whether Tiffany and Company is trolling or fishing for press, but they've definitely succeeded. The luxury company has unleashed a line of needlessly expensive everyday objects, appropriately named everyday objects. While ridiculously expensive pants and needlessly flashy objects have become somewhat of a mocking trend on the internet recently, Tiffany Company has pushed the envelope with this one. What you will find is a $420 protractor. Remember that thing that would help you, I guess, measure angles and such in school? $425, and you've got it. $250 for a crazy straw.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, I know there's also a ball of yarn that is going for, I believe it's a silver silver ball of yarn. That's going for around $9,000, I believe. I might have to double check.
Like it's,
even if it's $900, I don't really care if I get the number wrong. It's needlessly expensive. And the final one was a can. It was like a tin can. I believe it's a replica tin can because I believe it's made from another material that's selling for, you know what, I forget the price. Let's just make one up, $45,000. I don't know what it is. It might be $1,000. It might be either way. It's more than the 7 cents that a tin can costs.
Right. Listen, if you're the sucker that's buying this stuff just because it has Tiffany & Co. on it, then I feel sorry for you. Because $9,000 for a ball of yarn, why don't you go down to Len's Mill Store and buy it for 90 cents?
$1,000 for that tin can. But do you
that's
think
ridiculous.
Do you think this is real, or do you think we've been goaded here? Do you think this is just Tiffany Company making a little push for some type of publicity? It's tough to say words sometimes.
I guess so, huh?
Do you think it's a stunt that they're doing that I don't know the intention, I don't know why they're doing it, but do you think this is all a ploy to get us James Sebastian Scott and Jeff Pickle talking about it on a Wednesday morning?
Sure. Sure it is. Because guess what? There's a season coming up called Christmas, and they want their stuff to be pushed out there and their name to be pushed out there. And a ploy like this is just going to give them the attention that they want. And a $9,000 ball of yarn, I don't care who you are. I'm not paying that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? We have a caller who's waiting online who we were chatting with about the college strike before I suddenly shifted gears. I'm never going to turn a caller away. So let's hear, Ian, what's your take on the college strike? Going back to the previous segment, I'd still love to hear what you have to say.
Hey, basically, I would ask that anyone who is really wanting to know about the college strike to really read some of the articles. There's some anonymous faculty have posted articles, but there's a lot there that people are not getting. The fact that there is so much administration now involved in colleges, and they're making like six figures. And then we got the part-time partial load teachers who have really, it's precarious work. You don't know whether the next term you're actually going to be working, and when you have to apply again to teach the same course that you just did 4 months previous, it's a bit ridiculous. I'm all for the students. I understand the frustrations. I hugely understand the frustration because they want to get their education. I know people, I have a friend of mine whose daughter is going to be supposed to be graduating at the end of this term, and she's hugely frustrated. But what has to be said and has to be done is that the faculty is not getting a fair handshake on this stuff. The administrative aspect, they just keep growing. They keep adding more administrators with all this tuition money that, you know, that is coming in. And yet the faculty is not going more full-time. It's going more precarious, part-time, partial load. And academic freedom is another big problem. So please, read into the actual issues. And I think you'll realize that the students are actually going to get a better education and a better system if we can get this worked out.
Yeah, you know what, Ian? Yeah, thanks so much for the call. I think you did touch on a really important point there. And that's something I've spoken with the faculty members about, saying that, hey, you know what, who isn't doing precarious work, you know, whose salaries are not getting cut down at all? The administration, the people working for the colleges, they're the ones who are not seeing any of these, negative detract. They're not the ones who don't know what they're doing, you know, semester to semester. So that's a great point raised by Ian. Joined now in studio by none other than Mike Farwell. Mike, how are you doing this morning?
I want the students to be able to go back to class, Jeff. Do you want me to pick up right there? I like Ian. He makes a lot of good points. Put the students back in class. Make teaching an essential service. Get this thing sorted out. You are hurting innocent pawns in this game.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not sure if you were able to listen in with the students I had in this morning talking about, the fact that even if they are able to go back to class now, they've missed 4 weeks, you know, how much of that vital hands-on education, which is what you get in the colleges, hands-on education, are they not getting now that, you know, close to 4 weeks, potentially more, has been wasted?
This just keeps going on and on. There was a strike at Conestoga College when I was there in the mid-1990s. I believe this is the fifth since Lanalee Hardacre, when she's the head of OPSU out of Conestoga College, when we first talked. I believe she said this is the fifth in her time there since the late 80s. It's just got to stop.
Yeah, I think you sum up the points of a lot of people. Basically, everyone except for those involved in the conflict itself. Mike, we got a couple seconds here. What are we looking forward to on the Mike Farwell Show?
Rim Park, after the financing fiasco in Waterloo, an audit committee was assembled to help the city council manage its finances, and one councillor thinks maybe it's time that this audit committee goes by the wayside. So we're going to talk about that at 10:30 with Councillor Mark Whaley, and then at 11 o'clock, should we be concerned about gun violence here in Canada? Perhaps we should. We'll discuss it at 11.
All right, I'll be listening in. Mike Farwell coming up in just a couple minutes right after the news. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to producers Dina and James, making me look good and sounding good, more importantly, given we're on the radio. Thanks so much for listening. We're ahead to the news and the Mike Farwell Show right after this.